All right, let's get the show on the road. Thank you all for coming. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be here. With me up here, and Matt, Mike, just go sit down, is Michael Copps will speak next, and then on the cell phone over there, walking away to do a radio interview probably, and he's waiting to raise some money in the parking lot for someone, my friend John Nichols. But he'll be back in time to talk in 20 minutes or so after Mike and I have given our words. We're here to talk about medium-form movement in the U.S. today, a movement that right now is in the midst of probably the defining fight of the movement since it began really in earnest about 15 years ago, the modern media reform movement. And I've been a part of it, both of my writings, and John Nichols and I helped form a group called Free Press. I hope you all are members. It's free. Go to freepress.net. It's guiding a lot of the organizing around the issues we'll be talking about today, some of them. But, you know, before we get to talk about net neutrality and ownership and some of the issues that Mike Copps and John are going to talk about, I just want to put the whole movement in context for progressive politics, for people here at PopFest. I think what happened was that around 15 years ago in the 1990s, there was a growth in interest among people in places like, you know, progressives in Wisconsin with the importance of media, for the way people understood politics, the way politics was covered, affected the way things took place in the country. And so influencing, controlling media became a very important issue. People understood its significance. And that's when the whole question of media monopoly, the one company gobbling up all the media and able to have it convey its opinion, became a central concern for progressives, and actually a concern across the political spectrum, not just progressives, still primarily progressives, because progressives didn't own any of the media, especially with the receiving end. So it was a dire and immediate concern. And when we started Free Press, the whole idea was that we would emphasize the importance of media to having a democratic society. And then we tried to put in place policies so we'd have a more diverse media, we'd have competitive media, we'd also have a stronger community and nonprofit media system that would be diverse as well and have competition there. And most of all, we would try to make sure we had an internet that wasn't the private plaything of a handful of monopolistic corporations. It was open, uncensored, ubiquitous, available to all. That was the founding principles of this movement. And we've had a lot of success in some areas, but we've also, you know, we're going up against the most powerful forces in our society, and let's be blunt, when you go up against those powerful forces in American society, it's hard to win. You have to line up a lot of people to beat organized money, and we're going up against serious organized money. Now, what's happened in the media reform movement since, say, 2000 to 2005, is that the stakes have grown much higher than they were then. What we talked about in the late 90s and a decade ago is really small potatoes compared to where the movement is now and the issues that we face are now. Let me give you an example of how this has happened. The internet has changed everything. It really has. It's totally turned upside down media, communication, and our whole political economy. And it's aggravated and elevated some of the problems to a much more severe and much more important level where they need attention. So, you know, when we talked about the giant media companies 15 years ago, Viacom and Time Warner and the mergers they were doing, we talked about how big they got and how much they controlled, we were talking maybe about five or six companies that each ranked among the 100 or 200 largest companies in the United States in terms of sales or market value. So they were big guys, right? But they were in the club with the car companies and all the other big corporations. They were part of the team. They weren't the biggest companies by any stretch of the imagination in the economy. They were usually ranked between 50 and 100 or 150. Now we go to the digital era. We go to an era in which the internet has become the private plaything of a handful of monopolies. Monopolies. And I use that sense, unless it's meant to be used by economists. Monopolies. And a monopoly, the way economists use the term, doesn't mean one company sells all the product. It just means one company sells enough of a product that it can determine how much competition it has by the price it sets. John D. Rockefeller had the greatest monopoly in capitalism's history of Standard Oil. He never had more than 83% of the market share. He didn't need 100%. If he wanted to raise it to 90, all he had to do was lower the prices a little bit and knock some more people out of business. But he found the most profitable place for him to be was to allow 70% of people to stay in the market. And he had 83%, that was where he wanted to be. That's considered a monopoly. He doesn't have to sell all the oil in the country. So when we talk about Microsoft, when we talk about Google, when we talk about Facebook and Apple and Amazon and eBay, and we call them monopolies, They're monopolies because they, in their core areas, they have market share oftentimes equal to or exceeding what John D. Rockefeller had with Standard Oil. Equal to or exceeding. So if we look at those companies and say, okay, this is the digital economy, these are the big guys, what do we find? Well, I just checked this yesterday. I went down the list of the most valuable companies in the American economy. And there are 35 American companies that are valued at $100 billion or more. 35. Of those 35, 13 are internet monopolies. Three of the four largest, most valuable companies in our economy are internet monopolies. Seven of the top 17. They totally dominate our economy today. And what you find that's striking is there are no internet companies between 35 and 100. They're all at the top. There's just a few of them. There's not like a big middle class of regional internet semi-monopolies. There's just the giants I talked about. Just those giants. They control, they own the board. They don't face any competition. They're creating communities to compete with each other. They totally dominate in a way the media giants could only have fantasized about 15 years ago. These companies have power. They also have lavish public relations, so we don't have to worry about them. These are all cool, hip people who own these monopolies. They play hacky sack, and they do frisbee, and they love their dogs. So they, who could worry about these nice people doing all these wonderful things for free, giving us these great services? Well, that is something I hopefully we're getting over that phase of idiocy. We realize that these are extraordinarily powerful commercial concerns that use their power to dominate the politics of the country, the culture of the country, as well as the economics, to advance their self-interest. And I think we're going to find, as we're already beginning to find, that addressing these companies is going to be job one of American politics. We cannot reconcile having a handful of monopoly companies that make the Gilded Age robber barons look like a bunch of pipers, have these guys dominating our society in the way they do, and then still maintaining remotely close to a free, just society, a democracy. Those two things are simply incompatible, and we're going to have to address it. And that takes media reform at a whole different level than it was 15 years ago. 15 years ago, it was a side issue along with a bunch of other important issues, campaign finance, civil rights, we had a whole lot of things, peace and justice. Now suddenly we're talking about the very nature of our economy. And this becomes especially important in a digital economy because what we're seeing is that, tragically, with the immersion of digital technologies, it has it's been a great boon for the owners of Microsoft and Apple and Google and eBay and Facebook. But it hasn't created that many jobs. This has not been like the automobile revolution. It's created this massive middle class of well-paying union jobs across the industrial Midwest and across the country. Instead, this is a job killer. And we're seeing now the beginning of even low-paying jobs are being eliminated. So we have very serious questions that are being raised by the digital revolution economically that have to be addressed by progressives. It's going to be the dominant issue of our lifetimes, especially if any of us have children like I do who are living in your home still like I do. Hope this isn't being recorded. Believe that part. My daughter will be after me. You can see the difficulty of the labor market. So that's one thing. Now there's one branch of these monopolies that is especially pernicious. I mean, you could say, well, at least Google and Microsoft and Apple and Amazon, they provide a product of value, even though they get monopoly rents and they have all sorts of horrible other things going on. But there's one group of these monopolists, Verizon, AT&T, and Comcast, which are a cartel. They basically are government-created monopolies with government licenses that give them monopoly power to have telephone and cable service, and they parlayed it into complete control over cell phones, smartphones, and broadband internet access. And they're a cartel because they actually divide up the market between them. They say, you get this, you get that, they agree on maximum prices, they don't compete. And as a result, we have in this country the worst quality of internet access and smartphone service and the highest prices of any major country in the world. We were number one with a bullet 15 years ago when it came to internet access, when it came to all developments in the digital revolution. Now, depending on what measure you look at, we're between 15 and 30 and we're falling every year. Now, Google got so frustrated with the cartel of AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast that it actually went into Kansas City and started something called Google Plus. And they said, look, jerks, basically, I'm paraphrasing. They said to the cartel, we're going to create, we'll show you what they do in other countries. We're going to create broadband that works. And they created a broadband system in parts of Kansas City that's 100 times faster than what any of us can get, thanks to the cartel. 100 times faster, and it doesn't cost anymore. In fact, the cost, if they build on a cross country, much lower, because the costs are very low as we build on a network. 100 times faster, so people in those areas don't have to pay for satellite or cable TV. Because you have that much speed, you can bring everything right in over the network. You don't have to fork out another couple $100 a month. That's what we're physically capable of. That's what the technology is capable of, but the cartel will never do it, because they make a lot more money charging through the teeth, not investing in their networks, and then just the money they do invest goes to buy off the politicians to make sure they don't have to worry about anyone pushing them and challenging their monopoly status. So that's what we're dealing with. And that cartel, this is the battle you're going to hear about from Commissioner Copps in a second on network neutrality. It's all about that cartel, because they're trying to use their dominance and their power over internet and cell phone access to effectively privatize the internet and give them control over the bottleneck to determine who can use the network under what terms. It won't be open and accessible to all of us. The great people oftentimes thought the internet was a magical technology. It was somehow created magically, and it was impossible to be censored. It was impossible for anything bad to happen. Well, we now know that no, it's not a magical technology. It was a policy that made it open. It wasn't a technology, it was a policy. And when that policy changes, the technology can be used in very dangerous ways. And I think now, a year ago, that was like, oh, come on, man, you're smoking weed. No, today we know, thanks to Edward Snowden, that that's exactly how it's being used, not simply by the government, by commercial institutions. The profit model, the business model of these giant firms, of Microsoft, Facebook, Apple, and Amazon, is commercial vacuuming up of all possible data about everything we do at all times online. That's what they do. It's not just the government. So these are big issues now. This is a lot bigger stake than whether you have 5 radio stations or 11 radio stations by different owners in a community. This gets right to the heart, right into the bone marrow of the future of our society. And then finally, the last great issue that has really changed in the last 15 years has been the commercial model of journalism, which most Americans grew up with and thought was just something naturally existed, never had to worry about, and we'd always have commercial journalism, is gone. In fact, it is dead. We have probably 40% the number of paid working journalists today per capita as we had 20 years ago in America. It's plummeting. Most of the things that take place between politicians and commercial interests are no longer covered in America. We simply aren't covered. You know, it's great. You see some of the big scandals that have been broken in America that have cost politicians their jobs, like the scandal in Virginia with Bob McConnell recently. That story was broken by a reporter at the Washington Post. If that reporter didn't have a job, Bob McConnell would be going strong today. So would his wife. In the last decade, you saw big scandals that sent Cunningham, the congressman, to jail, the Jack Abramoff scandal. All those scandals were broken by reporters. That's what alerted the public to them and got those people in jail. The reporters who broke all the scandals in the last decade are no longer working. Those jobs don't exist. Those scandals would not be reported today. We're losing journalism. And the internet, rather than saving us, is making it worse, because what the internet has done is it's ended the ability of advertising to support journalism. Advertising gave between 50 and 80% of all the revenues that supported journalism in this country from 1880 until today. All that's being erased by the internet, because once advertisers go online, they no longer buy websites and hope you go there and see the ad. And they go to a news website. Instead, they go to Google or Apple or Amazon or Yahoo and say, I want to reach a million women 18 to 24, and they'll find you wherever you are because they know everywhere you go. They don't have to worry about buying it on a website. They get you direct hit wherever you go. And because of that, the money that used to go to journalism to pay for all these reporters no longer exists. Commercial journalism is dying. Well, you don't have to be a genius or a political theorist to understand that the whole notion of self-government and the rule of law is predicated on people being able to govern their own lives, and you have to know what's going on. You have to have journalism. So the framers of this country, the founders of it, instituted massive postal subsidies to make sure we have a vibrant press system so we could actually engage in self-government. Well, we're at that moment again today, that we were in 1776 and 1787 and 1791. We've got to come up, take it seriously. We have to build a democratic infrastructure of journalism, independent, uncensored, competitive journalism, probably nonprofit for the most part, so we know what's going on, so we have to govern ourselves and aren't just the victims of one propaganda campaign after another, which is the state we're in today. So the stakes, again, to conclude, are high. They're higher than they've ever been. And they're going to come down on a series of fights, a series of political battles over the next few years. And the battle we're facing right now, that's taking place in Washington today, There's actually several of them, but the one that it's typified by what's called network neutrality, which is, again, is the effort of the cartel of AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon to privatize the internet and give them the right basically to say, your website's allowed on our network, yours isn't. Something they don't currently have. They basically privatize the internet, and they can discriminate against users of services and basically make it a private fiefdom for them to maximize their commercial return and give them extraordinary political power in this country. And right now we have basically two sides of this equation. On one side of the fence are these three handful of companies that stand to make even more money, if that's possible, from privatizing the internet. On the other side of the fence are everyone else in the human race who are going to be royally screwed if this happens. And it will be a measure of the corruption of our political system, how this plays out. Because you basically have untold amounts of money from these companies buying off politicians right and left versus the sentiment of the vast majority of Americans across the political spectrum on the other side. And that's it. If there's ever been a test of money versus people, this issue is it. There's no one that says, yeah, I studied it as a citizen, and I think the human race would be much better if these companies could basically censor. They divvied up the market, and the one company I have, like internet access, can censor the websites for me and let me see what they think I ought to see, and charging me more to see other sites. I think that would be good. No one says that, except shareholders in these companies. They think that's a great idea, because they hear the cash registers are singing. So we're a great test in front of us. It's going on right now. Commissioner Copps, the second, will tell you more about it. There's other stuff, too, but this is a happening issue. This is a central issue. It's a defining issue. If you aren't involved in it, go to freepress.net. A little bit about our next speaker up here. Some of you probably already heard Commissioner Copps speak this morning. He followed me then on the podium. Michael Copps, a native of Milwaukee, was a member of the Federal Communications Commission for 10 years, wasn't it, Mike? 2001 to 2011. Democratic member of the 5-member commission in the minority most of that time, except for his last 2 years. And he was one of the great giant progressive voices at the FCC during that era, in which a number of great issues came before. We could always count on Michael Copps to do the right thing. And I think what was most striking about Michael Copps was he was committed to doing events like this. He was committed at all times, so I remember this, to going out, let's hear what the people in the country actually think. Let's hear what they might be interested in. What sort of media system they would like. And I don't know how many of these public hearings you did. It must have been at least 70, 80?
That's about right.
70 or 80. And we're talking about events. This would be a small event compared to many of these events. He would go into cities and stay there for hours and hours and get feedback. And what it did was it energized Mike, because he could see how much interest there was in having a healthy media system in this country. And the FCC culture had always been behind closed doors. They had no idea, a phalanx of corporate lobbyists surrounding the building. They had no idea that anyone else cared about these issues. And Mike showed, no, a lot of people do care. And it's been an honor to work with him for the last 10 years, and with no further ado, let him take the podium here.
That's a tough act to follow. Thank you very much. Fighting Bob McChesney, I'm going to be. It's him right here, Fighting Bob McChesney. We covered so much of the terrain here, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time adding a lot, and I want to hear from you and do some questions and answers, too. But a couple of things that I would add. He talks about the importance of these issues and the centrality of the issues. I don't think there's an issue more important facing the United States of America right now than the fate of our news and information and our media ecosystem. I just walked through the great hall over here, and there are so many issues that are important to you and important to me that are on the nation's agenda right now. But none of those issues, not a one of those issues, is going anywhere until we get a media that tees up those issues, that covers those issues, that digs for facts, that holds power accountable, and that tells the truth. But we don't have that anymore. I lived through almost 11 years at the FCC. I was in the minority during the Bush years. You can imagine how much fun that was. I saw media consolidation. Just, you know, I went there and I thought, boy, this is going to be absolutely the coolest job in the world. I'm going to be on the cutting edge of all of these issues, meet the movers and shakers who are going to transform our globe, who are going to take advantage of all these new technologies and to help democratize our society. And then I got there, and the first knock on the door was the CEO of some big media company. I think that's when Chris Kraft and Fox were joining hands. And Michael Powell called me on the telephone. He was the chairman of the commission and said, "We really need your help on this, in this first issue that you're facing here at the FCC." And the CEOs come in and talk about all these efficiencies and economies that their merger is going to bring. So can't you help us? So I obviously voted against that, but it passed. And then, you know, the next one came in and said, "Well, you just let these folks merge, you got to let me merge now." And then the next day, and I bet you I spent 75% of my time at the FCC rather than exploring all these vistas and doing all these neat things that I was going to do to bring communications closer to the people, listening to these folks telling me how great their mergers were going to be for our media infrastructure. And then you looked outside the building and you saw, as Bob was just talking about, the diminution of journalism, the firing of journalists, the closing of newsrooms, the lack of localism. The local station closes up, it's taken over by somebody who's 2,000 or 3,000 miles away. You've got basically 5 or 6 big companies controlling the internet. What does that do to local news? What does that do to diversity in communities? What does that do to coverage of the different cultures of the community? What does it do to minorities? What does it do to women who have no ownership opportunity? There are such few in this country of ours. So we went through that for year after year after year. And now we sit, as Bob says, with a media that doesn't reflect this country at all. It doesn't tee up the issues it should be teeing up. The issues aren't teed up by the people who really feel them, and the FCC sits inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C., instead of coming out and hearing from the people how the decisions that it's about to make are going to affect their lives. So I could go on what's happened to our media and the homogenization of programming, the dumbing down of our democratic dialogue, but we can talk more about that later, and I think this crowd understands that pretty well right now. The second point that I really want to emphasize is the importance of now, right now. These issues are coming to a head at the Federal Communications Commission as we speak. The decisions that the Federal Communications Commission will make in the next few months on the future of the open internet, on these network neutrality rules, and on pending mergers like this ridiculous Comcast, Time Warner Cable merger. Isn't a great idea to take the two companies that people think are the worst companies in the United States of America from the standpoint of consumer service and let them combine so they can just control the whole shooting match when it comes to our communications system is beyond me. But between now and I think the end of the year, the FCC is going to vote not just on that merger, but on the future of the open internet on these so-called net neutrality rules. And you can get in the weeds very, very quickly on this. I think most of you are familiar with what we're talking about here. What it comes down to is that while I was on that, in the minority on that Republican commission at the FCC, they decided, they saw the internet coming down the road, and big business saw the internet coming down the road, and saw all these wonderful opportunities to make a profit. So the business came in to the majority and said, "You know, we'd be a lot better off if we didn't have any regulation at all. We don't want to have the consumer protections, the privacy protections, reasonable prices and costs that apply to the plain old telephone service. So here's a good idea. Let's not call the internet telecommunications. Let's call it something else and get it out from under the law where those consumer protections reside in Title II of the Telecommunications Act." And I know this gets kind of wonky, I guess, but it's really important that you understand this Title II thing. We need to get the broadband internet back under Title II of the Communications Act so that a public interest-oriented commission so So the commission can exercise this public oversight. How can you have what Bob was talking about, this monopoly, the private sector monopoly, and then no government oversight whatsoever? I mean, you got to make up your mind what you're going to have in the future of the country. There's always been this battle between regulation, and if you're going to have if you're going to have monopolies, regulate them. Now these guys want it all. They want the whole nine yards. They want no regulations. They want to take this out from under the rubric of the law. So this is what the FCC is talking about right now, the future of the internet. When I started out going to these meetings years ago, a lot of people would say, well, that Cops, he's kind of an old guy, and he's talking about radio, and he's talking about television, and he's talking about cable, and that's all consigned and going to be shortly consigned to the ash heap of history. We've got our internet now, and this technology is so dynamic, it's so far, it's immune. I don't need to worry about what he's talking about, because the internet's going to evolve, and I'll be fine if it's open, and there's no way that anybody's going to control this. But as Bob made so clear in his remarks now, it's not the technology that controls where this thing is going and how it's going to develop. It's government policy. And all these people will say, well, you've got to let the internet go and just let it, the inevitable laws of the marketplace. But as Bob said, we are where we are right now because of bad policy that was made by government. Don't just blame the internet service providers, although I do blame them for a lot. But it's not just them. It was the aiding and abetting by the government, particularly by the FCC in the years while I was there. Usually I'm talking from the sending side. But those were the policies that deregulated plain old telephone service, that deregulated especially the broadband internet, and that blessed every single monopoly and cartel and merger combination that came along. And those aren't laws that come from the hand of God or the laws of nature or some inevitable working of a marketplace. Those come from policy. And we've had 20 years or more of really god-awful policy when it comes to telecommunications and media. So, fast forward to right now. 1.5 million people in the last few months have written to the FCC saying, we want to have a Title II classification for the broadband internet so it can work in behalf of the public interest. So the little guy can start his or her blog, so that innovation can flourish, so that democracy can flourish, so we can have thousands and hundreds of thousands of new voices, and we're going just in the opposite direction on the internet right now. It's going down the same road that radio, television, and cable went down. And it's pretty far advanced. It's got a bad case of it already. So we have, right now, between now and the time the FCC votes in the next few months, to make sure it votes the right way. And that's where I need your help. What I'd like you to do, really, is take out and I mentioned this morning, but if you didn't get a chance to do it this morning, take out your cell phone and go to www.commoncause/openinternet, and we'll make sure your message gets to the FCC by Monday. Why is Monday important? Because this open internet proceeding, public comment closes on it on Monday afternoon. So this is your chance. You really feel this is important to you. This is your chance to have some input. www.commoncause/openinternet. commoncause.org/openinternet. And we'll make sure it gets there. And that message will be to the FCC. We don't want Verizon and Comcast and AT&T controlling the future of the internet. We don't want any company telling us what news we can hear and what we're not going to hear, or what advocacy group we're going to hear from. Are we going to hear from the progressive community at all, or are these big companies going to block it, slow it down, degrade it? Right now, there are no rules on the open internet. The court threw out the weak ones that were there. So right now, it's perfectly legal for any of these companies that we were talking about before just to block anything that they want to. So let's fix that, and let's fix that right now. And let's realize, as we walk through that great hall over there and all those issues, that not one of those issues can be resolved in a way that's friendly to the public interest, and in a way that's sustainable of the democracy that we live in, unless we have a media infrastructure that supports it. And right now that means Title II classification, it means net neutrality, it means open internet, it means saying no to consolidation. And if we don't do it now, I think the FCC will decide in the wrong way, and you won't be able to undo that for years. That's going to set the course of the internet, I think, for the better part of a generation. So help us out on that, and let's, I think together we can win this fight. The forces that Bob and John talk about, of the big money and the Barons of the Gilded Age and the Koch brothers and just the power of Comcast and all of these companies, that's a steep, steep climb to overcome that. But it's been overcome before. Reform can overcome that. The grassroots can overcome that. And we've got to get started with those 1.5 million people, but we need to double or triple that in the months ahead. And people like Bob and John are devoting their lives to doing that. No one does this with more flair than they do. And my favorite journalist, John Nichols, sits right out here, your hometown hero. He's my hero too. He and Bob founded Free Press. I happen, I'm lucky enough to serve on the board of that organization too. But Bob and John come with this with a passion and an enthusiasm and a knowledge that's really rare. And I think one of my favorite speakers on the face of God's green earth is the person that I'm about to call up here, who's John Nichols. You know as much about John as I, because he's a hometown boy. But he's got it not just in that big brain of his up here, but he's got it in his heart here. And this is a guy who is totally committed, and it is an honor for me to turn this podium over to John Nichols.
On the Federal Communications Commission, who's actually on our side, not their side. Almost 15 years ago, Bob McChesney and I wrote a book called It's the Media Stupid. And our argument was that media should never be the first issue of your life, not even of our lives. Media should always be your second issue. If you want to stop a war, we're not going to come to you and tell you, oh, make that secondary. War and peace, that's secondary. If you care about Gaza and Palestine and Israel and the Middle East, we're not going to come to you and say, oh, make that your second issue. Don't worry about that up front. If you care about hunger and poverty, we're not going to say, make that your second issue. Come and work on our issue, because that's been the crisis of our politics. We have so many people show up and say, just do what we want you to do. Just do what we want you to do and everything will be fine. We don't believe that. We believe it does matter to end illegal and immoral wars and to avoid the next illegal and immoral war. Yeah. We believe it does matter to focus on poverty and inequality and injustice at home and around the world, and we don't think that that should be second to any other issue. But Bob McChesney and I and Michael Copps, 15 years ago, Ann told us, we knew something was happening, and it was a crisis. We knew that the change in our media, the consolidation of our media, first into 50 big companies, then into 20 big companies, then into 12 big companies, then into 5 big companies, down, 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 merger after merger after merger, was cutting out the dialogue, not strengthening the dialogue. We knew that eventually we were headed toward a situation where we would have a handful of not companies but individuals deciding what our dialogue is about. And I don't know how many of you cared about Salvador and Nicaragua back in the 1980s, but they used to talk about El Salvador. They used to say, oh, 13 families control El Salvador. It's an unjust, terrible system. Well, my gosh, I long for the days when we had 13 companies controlling our media. This is a crisis situation. We started talking about that 15 years ago, and what we said to everyone was this. Whatever your first issue is, you keep fighting on it with your heart and your soul. But understand that your second issue must be the media, because the bottom line is this. If you have a media system that does not tell the truth, if you have a media system that does not function in a basic democratic, small d democratic model, then you will never get your first issue resolved. The bottom line is, fix the media and we're going to fix everything else. That's how it works. So I'll tell you something, guys. Bob and I are the weakest, lamest players you're ever going to need. Boy, don't even ask us to set up the chairs. It's a disaster. When the good Lord was handing out the organizer genes, boy, he looked at Bob and me and he said, well, we're out. We gave all the good stuff to everybody else. And so we didn't know what to do with all these good ideas we had. We're thinking, where does this go? And we thought, well, maybe we'll write a book and everything great will happen. And you know what? It was a weird thing. It didn't all happen right away. We thought, well, maybe we'll organize Fighting Bob Fest up in Baraboo. Everything will happen from there. And in a funny way, it did. But here's what happened that really mattered. Bob and I went on Bill Moyers' show in the start of 2003. And he gave us an hour to talk about media power, media systems, media structures. Not 2 minutes, not a half minute, an hour to do it. But the weird thing was, we were only supposed to do a half hour. And Bill did this sort of wink and nod at his staff, and they kept the camera rolling. And I got to talk about my mom and the local papers, and I got to talk about Wisconsin, and Bob got to talk about all these structures of media and all this stuff. And you know what an amazing thing happened? Everything we had been saying was proven true. The power of the media, because Bill Moyers gave us that 1 hour on television back in 2003, and our book, our little book, which, you know, certainly was selling at a satisfactory rate to us, but not to anybody else. Our little book, Bob and I, we were like Amazon junkies. We were sitting there on that Friday night and that Saturday morning and that Sunday morning. Our little book went from 10,000 on Amazon to 8,000. To 5,000, to 1,000, to 300, to 100, to 10, to 5. We went to number 3 on Amazon. People across this country, they heard about this issue and they said, I want to read about this issue. I want to get involved. That's the power of media if we actually can just communicate a little bit of our truth. Not on this issue, not on media, but on any issue, if we can just break through, there is a great mass of decent, good Americans who are ready to grab hold of it and fight with us to get this stuff right. They're out there, but the media system gets between our good ideas and their good intentions. And so, we still didn't know what to do with that. And our friend, now how many of you people, it depends on the color of your hair, I'll know whether your answer to this question. How many of you people remember Midge Miller? That's right, Sister Midge Miller. Midge Miller, whose basic premise was, if there's a fight, can I get into the middle of it? But usually she had started it in the first place. She was the most wonderful, lovely woman, just did a few important things in her life, nothing major. Took down President Lyndon Johnson by organizing the McCarthy Challenge in Wisconsin, wrote the major legislation that protected women in the home, in the workplace in Wisconsin, one of the most critical legislative players we've ever met. But the most important thing Midge Miller did for us was, I was sitting around with her one day talking about, you know, all this stuff. She said, you know what? It's great to talk about this, But you ought to organize a national conference on media reform. And you ought to have it in Madison. And if you do, I'll get all my old ladies from over at the senior center to come and help and put it together. And I tell you, I want to emphasize one thing. There is no promise greater than somebody telling you they're going to get all the old ladies to work on something because they actually know how to work on stuff. And so something amazing happened, brothers and sisters. We called the National Conference on Media Reform in 2003, and we had no idea what was going to happen. We didn't even have a lock on our equipment. We had the microphones and the speakers, and we didn't know how to lock them up the night before. Our organizer, Adam Benedetto, who ran for sheriff in Dane County, and thus, in our view, it qualified him to be the security guy. Adam Benedetto had to sleep with the equipment the night before because we didn't know how to lock it up. But boy, when that event came, down there on State Street, that theater was filled every single seat. And people had come from all over this country. Micah Cox came and joined us. We had kids in Iraq emailing us that night saying, I wish I could be with you because what you are talking about is why I'm here in Iraq fighting a war that we shouldn't be fighting. We had people around the world beaming in, connected to this movement. And that had real power. The only thing I'm going to tell you, the last important thing that I will tell you today, the immense power of what came together because Mitch Miller said, stop talking, start organizing. Stop visioning out something and actually start doing something. Give people something to hook into. In that year, 2003, George Bush was at roughly the peak of his popularity. He had immense strength. He had had very successful elections. He was in a tremendous, not the first election when he lost, but I mean, I'm talking the 2002 election. He was in a position of immense authority, and he proposed to knock down the barriers to media consolidation. He proposed to blow out everything that kept our media from becoming a complete corporate entity. Not that it isn't that, but even worse. This is a huge proposal, and something amazing happened. Millions of Americans organized, and at the heart of the Bush administration, not when he and Cheney were the least popular, at the heart of their administration, when they were at the peak of their strength, we prevented him from going forward and doing what he wanted to do. This media reform movement organized left and right, Democrat, Republican, up and down, we stopped George Bush from allowing massive consolidation of our media. That is a huge power, and that came because Mitch Miller said, call a meeting. Because Michael Cox was on the FCC. Because people like you got involved and got organized. And I want to tell you, we're at that tipping point once more. What these people are telling you about net neutrality is real. If we lose the ability to have a free and open internet, we will lose the future of communications in this country. Just as they took television from us, just as they took radio from us, they will take the internet from us and make it into a propagandistic entity which sells things and sells ideas, but which never ever delivers on the promise of a real and democratic discourse. That is the fight we are in. It is the critical communication struggle of our times, and we can have no permanent friends. We can't say, oh, I like you. I can't say, oh, you're a good person. No, it doesn't work like that. We need to go to every member of Congress representing Wisconsin, Democrat or Republican. We need to go to our friends and we need to say, no compromises, no middle ground on this stuff. We want net neutrality absolutely protected. Tammy Baldwin, we want you to sign on to fight with us for an absolute protection of net neutrality, and we want you to join with the other people in the Senate to do it. Nobody stands down on this. Everybody stands in. Mark Pocan, you're with us on so many of these issues. We know you're good, but we want you to take the lead on this issue. But then when we're done with Tammy, and we're done with Mark, And when we're done with Glenn Moore, then we have got to say, this one we don't stand down on. We go to the office of Ron Johnson. We go to the office of the most conservative members of our congressional delegation. We go to the office of Paul Ryan himself. And we say, Brother Ryan, you got to rise to this occasion, because this isn't about Democrat and Republican. It's not about liberal or conservative. This is about whether we have a democracy in America. Nobody gets to stand down from democracy. This is the vital fight of our time. You are so much a part of it. We would not have a movement if it wasn't for you. But now, when you have a movement, sometimes it's time to move. And we must move for net neutrality, because if we lose this fight, I'm going to tell you, everything else, peace and justice, decency, humanity, everything we fight for will begin to crumble, because we will have a corporate communication system so fully realized that all of our promises and all of our dreams will only be our promises and dreams, because our potential to truly communicate will be so dramatically undermined by an internet that realizes none of its promises and realizes all of the horrors that George Orwell imagined. You know, 60-some years ago, George Orwell said, the great fear is Big Brother is watching you. He was wrong. The great fear is that we're watching Big Brother. That we turn on a television, that we turn on a TV screen, we turn on a computer screen, we open up our phone, and instead of getting information that helps us to rule our own lives, we get information that helps somebody else to rule us. That's the struggle we're in, brothers and sisters, and we better win it. Thank you so much for being here.
Questions now. If someone wants to make a short speech, a really long one, there's a place out there behind that red card available, because we've only got like 10 or 12 minutes. And I think they're trying to record this, so I don't know what we're supposed to do about the mic situation. We'll repeat the question. Yes, sir, you're going to.
Oh, I'm too frozen.
Let me repeat the question. If the commission, referring to the FCC, is now Democratic, there are 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans, why are we talking about it voting the wrong way?
Because there's a lot of money in Washington, D.C., just like there's a lot of money in all of these political campaigns. It's very interesting when we're talking about net neutrality. Let's go right to the top and we can talk about the presidency itself. And the president has been on record saying, I will take a back seat to no one when it comes to net neutrality. This is a perfect time for him now to indicate, even though the FCC is an independent government agency that still listens when the President of the United States talks, to say, you know, for my part, I think the commission ought to be going this route, or, you know, if I have my druthers on policy, I like Title II classification. But when you're in a situation where the power of money, and let's be real candid about it and real frank about it, and you have the CEO of Comcast heading your advisory board on competitiveness and jobs, which is what we have right now, and we have this company going out doing lots of fundraisers for members of both parties, lots of them beholden to us, then you realize what you're up against in Washington, D.C. So it doesn't come down to party versus party or good guys versus bad guys. It comes down to that corrupting and debasing influence of big money in our politics right now. I used to teach American history way back in the dark ages, before most history was made, I guess. But you'd have to go back to the Gilded Age and the robber barons of the 1880s and the 1890s to find something on a par with what we have right now. It's that sweeping, it's that endemic, and it's that destructive. So we really have to, we got to push, like John just said, you go to both parties, you go to representatives wherever they are. These issues are not, they don't break down around the country this way. I've been to 70 or 80 of those hearings, maybe more than that. And it's red state, blue state, Republicans, Democrats. People have had enough of this corporatization of the news. They've had enough of this homogenization and taking all power out of the communities and putting it in the hands of a few companies. And we've got to get people in Washington, D.C. to understand that we, the people, are not going to put up with that anymore. This isn't going to be a gift coming from Washington. It's going to be because you get out those phones like I was talking about before, and you work and talk to your families and friends and colleagues and in the workplace and everywhere else and say, let's get this media right so we can get America right. There is no democratic reform until we have media reform. Back there, could you, yeah, please, back there.
Stay away from the blue acid.
That's right.
What do we have to say?
Actually, can you repeat that?
What kind of detail do we have to go into writing to have them actually pay attention to what we're saying? My understanding is a lot of times these things just kind of...
Okay, great question. The question is, Mike, and I'll let you answer this because you've been on the FCC and now you're part of the other side trying to send letters and emails. If you write these letters, you send the emails to the FCC or to members of Congress, don't they just get deleted and ignored after just like regarded as just, you know, a waste of time?
No, I don't think they do, but there has to be consequences when you do that. And there has to be people going to the polls and voting against these people, not letting them get away with, well, I'm for an open internet, sure, and then they have a completely different idea of what an open internet is. You have to get that message directly to them. We're not going to put up with this anymore. There has to be consequences. And it's a question of volume and scale and really hearing from the people back home. When we did round one of media consolidation back in 2002 and 2003, and I said to then Chairman Powell, let's go out on the road and hear from the American people. Well, he didn't want to do that because I think he and his Republican majority thought this is an inside the Beltway issue. Nobody really cares about this issue. So we'll just stay here, get the usual submissions from the industry, and then we'll do our thing. But we insisted, and my Democratic colleague at the time, Jonathan Allison, and I went out. We went to hearings held by members of Congress, put together by Free Press, Common Cause, and other groups, and hundreds of people would come out to these hearings. And then some of them go on to six, seven, we had one went 9 hours. Started at 5 o'clock in the evening, went on for 9 hours. Those made a difference, and I know they made a difference because I talked to members of Congress and the Senate afterwards as they were debating whether to overturn these rules that Michael Powell had jammed through the FCC, and some of them told me, you know, I went home to a town hall meeting in a place like this last week back in my district, back in my state, and somebody raised their hand and asked me about media ownership, and he said to me, I never thought media ownership was an issue. I didn't think anybody cared. But those people who told me that came back and voted to overturn the rules that Powell had gotten through. So even though we're all knowledgeable of the corrosive influence and the power that big money wields, in the final analysis, the grassroots can still work. And that's what has to happen here. And there's net neutrality and a media consolidation, and it has to happen right now. I think it can be done. And if it fails, then there has to be consequences at the polls. This has to be a real grassroots movement because that's where change comes from.
Looks like you're ready to go.
Groundhog Day and the issue of net neutrality and open net. Why?
No.
Groundhog Day.
This guy asked exactly the right question, except he has the wrong metaphor, the wrong film, I have to say. He asked, you know, why do we have this Groundhog Day situation? We seem to win net neutrality, and then we have to fight it all again a couple years later, right? It always comes back. And I like the Groundhog Day reference, because of course it's a fine film, I think one of the great metaphorical and philosophical films of our time. No Chip, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, but still excellent in its important meaning. However, I prefer the vampire films. Because you know when they're going after the vampire, right? They got the garlic first, and the garlic seems to work a little bit, and then that doesn't. Then they're doing the holy water, and then finally they're doing like a stake in the heart, and yet the vampire keeps rising up. And at some point, what you realize is you're going to have to probably be fighting these characters the rest of your life. And the truth of it is, whether you use the Groundhog's Day or a Dracula film thing, the bottom line is this. There are people who are paid an immense amount of money to get up every morning and look for any opening by which they could change our media system to make the people who pay them an immense amount of money a whole lot richer. And so the bottom line is very, very simple. Because we're dealing with these people, I bet you, that's Bernie Sanders calling. Shut them right off, because I you guys are more important. That's what you say to a crowd. No, but you need to understand this. This is the bottom line. There is so much money. There is so much money behind keeping this issue coming forward that every time we meet them, they will come back, because they're talking about making hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. The control of the internet is the control of an economic as well as a political future in this country. And so, are we gonna have to keep fighting on this issue for the long term? Yes, we are. And the bottom line is, if you take a look at history, there have been quite a few issues we've had to fight on again and again and again. We thought we had sorted out voting rights, but the court just messed with us on that yesterday. We thought we'd sorted out Social Security, but we got Paul Ryan running around Congress trying to privatize it. The bottom line is, you wanna be a progressive? You gotta wake up in the morning, you don't get the paycheck to go out and change the rules. You gotta fight to defend what we've achieved and keep on fighting time after time after time. That's why you join Common Cause, that's why you join Free Press, that's why you become a media reform activist, not for this year, not for this period of time, but you say, that's gonna be a part of who I am, because I wanna defend this American democracy, and I know we can't defend it unless we have a free and open internet and a free press in our society.
Unfortunately, I think we're supposed to close at 1:30, we were told, and I think the time is, the witching hour is upon us. We'll be up here to chat briefly on the way over to see the Kissers play. Thank you.
That's right. Thank you.